2005 to order.
How about the House?
Oh, the House, too. Excuse me. House also. We're a joint committee, aren't we?
Senators over there.
Lost my...
Look at him.
Hearing my perspective. We're going to hear on state bonding and debt insurance issuance. Excuse me.
Boy, I'm doing really good this morning.
And we'll start off right now. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Lockwood McCall, and I am the recently hired new director of debt management in the Oregon State Treasurer's Office. He did want to be here today and make some opening remarks. In his absence, I'll just go ahead with my presentation, and hopefully he'll be able to join us shortly.
Sure. Sounds good.
I've been here approximately 4 months, but I've had the opportunity to already work with the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission and to look at the state's debt capacity. So this presentation this morning is really a summary of that presentation. The goals that I'd hope to accomplish this morning would be to summarize the findings of the commission, to give you an analytical framework for evaluating the state's current debt position, and to assist the legislature in formulating future state capital spending plans. Very briefly, there are four major types of debt in Oregon. We have general obligation bonds that does require voter approval. Full faith and credit of the state is pledged. There are both general fund supported and non-general fund supported types of general obligation debt. Direct revenue bonds, there's a wide variety we'll be looking at briefly. They are created by the legislature through statute. In none of these cases are we pledging the state's pledge to pay. They're not secured by that. They're secured by their own revenue streams, and they're self-supporting. We also have appropriation credits. Greg will be talking a little bit more about that in his presentation, both certificates of participation and appropriation bonds. They generally are supported by general fund revenue streams, but they're not a full faith and credit type of a bond issue. And lastly, we have conduit revenue bonds, and there's a wide variety that we do throughout the state, and I'll only touch on those briefly. What I've tried to do today is to summarize for you, which is helping me as a new debt manager, sort of look at what's the big long history of what's been going on in Oregon for the last 20 years. And what you see is... back in 1985, there was primarily general obligation bonds with very little of other types of debt. As needs have changed and debt instruments have been created, we've moved into more appropriation credits and different types of direct revenue bonds. First, this is the history of general obligation debt. Back in the 80s, there was a lot of veterans general obligation debt, and those were for veterans mortgages. That has declined substantially over the last 20 years. And in this place, what you see is that a variety of other types of general obligation debt have come in. Most importantly, probably from your perspective, is the pension obligation bonds that were sold by the state in 2003 to address the unfunded liability of the pension system. Hi.
Mr. Treasurer, sir.
Sorry, Mr. Chairs.
No problem.
We were monitoring the TV. There was nobody here. All of a sudden, everybody's here, and we started. So, thank you. Apologize for being a little late.
No problem.
Good morning. My name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. I just wanted to briefly give you some comments, a little bit about my view of what's been happening of late in the state relative to our bonding programs, the state's credit, and the budget before you. I just want to first start by saying that the state's bond programs are really something that Oregon should be proud of. They are very sophisticated. The market likes our paper. We have great oversight in the state and checks and balances in selling bonds. You have done a good job in making sure we've taken advantage of low interest rates, and you will see through Laura's presentation, which she has begun, that Oregon has been taking advantage of this tool to improve economic development throughout the state of Oregon, to refinance some outstanding bonds, to take advantage again of low interest rates to save money, which again I think is something that all of us in this room have been looking to do. So Oregon really, I think, continues to be in good shape in selling and issuing debt on your behalf. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the state's credit. As you know, the state's bond rating continues to be a good investment grade rated bond. And you'll see from Laura as well, we have a variety of programs, that many of which are rated independent of the state's general obligation bond, which is typically the highest quality of debt that we have. But I want to say, as you've heard me say before, Oregon has been challenged with its credit rating. We did see a downgrade during the recession and the tough budget times. And I've mentioned this in the past, and I will continue to mention it. I think it was a wake-up call, and it continues to be a wake-up call for the state of Oregon in terms of why we got a downgrade. It is true, most states in this country were hit by this recession. Most states have had a huge challenge and continue to be challenged with their revenue streams in meeting the budget needs of the state, their representative states. But I want to say there were only a handful of states that actually received downgrades in their bond ratings. And when you look at some of the rationale behind why Oregon was downgraded, one has to really, I think, be somewhat concerned, because most of the changes and challenges that they saw in Oregon were more structural in nature. Yes, as I described earlier, Oregon has a very sophisticated and well-respected bond program, or programs, I should say. Yes, our paper in the marketplace is well-received. And the downgrade, though, represents, in my mind, a continued mark on Oregon's financial picture and viewpoint. We do pay a little bit more in interest as a result of that, slight, and in part because of low interest rates. That effect of a downgrade isn't financially as significant as it could be. I think one could assume that interest rates will rise over time, and that interest rate differential will cost us more over time. But the structural issues I've talked about, and I think you're well aware of, are we continue to have and have a tax system, which we've lived with for years, a very volatile tax system. Again, these are Wall Street's perspectives about the state of Oregon, not necessarily mine, although I think I share a lot of what they see. A volatile tax system, a tax code where when we have a good time, a good economic run in this state, we have a law, the kicker law, which does not allow the state to put money aside during the good economic times. We continue to have ending fund balances that are non-existent, and that's a more recent phenomenon. So, again, the state runs itself to the edge financially and then jumps into the next budget cycle with really no reserves, and therefore we have become in a position where we now have to issue notes to manage our cash, which was unprecedented in the state. While notes are a good tool, it is costing the state to sell those. And the last point, and this is one that I've talked to them time and time again, you got to realize these are people in New York who look at Oregon and the West Coast particularly and don't understand the initiative process, but they see that as a variable in the way in which Oregon can manage itself. And as a result of that, they have always had somewhat of a concern about all states that have an initiative system, and I think they continue to be concerned about what's changed in Oregon because of the initiative system. Measure 5, they have long watched Oregon struggle with Measure 5. Measure 11, they see where we pay for a prison expansion and operation straight out of the general fund. They're watching us closely on Measure 37 to see how that will financially impact Oregon, not only at the state level, but the local level. So they have had reason to be concerned about the initiative process. I keep reminding them that it's been here for 100 plus years, and we have worked our way through these things. But I think if you look at the cumulative changes in Oregon, particularly since ballot measure 5, they are more concerned about the longer-term aspects of Oregon's financial picture, and hence that's why we got the downgrade. My job, I hope, is to continue to work with them to show them that there are things that are happening positively in Oregon, and my encouragement to you is to continue to help us manage the situation. The last part is the budget. And first and foremost, having sat on that side of the dais, I can appreciate you have a very, very tough challenge before you. And I don't know if it's any more challenging than it was when you came in 2 years ago or 4 years ago or when I was in the legislature. It's always a question of needs, a budget, a tight budget, and trying to help Oregon. I want to say that I think you're in a sort of still, we all are still feeling the repercussions of this recession created, and probably you know better than I, a multi-billion dollar hole in Oregon. You continue to struggle with meeting basic needs in the state of Oregon. I'm telling you all things that you know, but I also want to encourage you to continue to work hard at looking at how government works and operates itself, whether that's at the budget level, finding efficiencies and accountability, which we all want to hear and talk about. But I also want to encourage you to continue to look for revenue options that might enhance some of the needs of the state of Oregon. And recently, I came out publicly to say, I think, and I think I encourage all of you to, for example, to look at the way in which we run the lottery system and the commissions that we have with lottery. Here, I believe, is an opportunity to find tens of millions of dollars in extra money that we are giving tavern owners in the state for running the games that we actually have become very reliant upon. But I think, as the treasurer, as a citizen, that we have for too long let the commissions go, in which we, I think, from a business point of view, should be much more scrutinous in what is that relationship, where's the balance, and juxtapose the money we're giving to these people versus the need of the state of Oregon. And that's just one example, I think, where we need to continue to look at, are we doing the best in running government for the citizens of the state of Oregon? Again, I appreciate that you're in a very tough position. I want to extend my offer that any way in which I can help you, my office can help you, we're here. And again, I see that Laura's already started, so with that, I know she'll continue on. But I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and to offer my office's assistance in helping you weather this challenging time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. Appreciate your leadership, quite frankly, in our state and a lot of these very tough issues. And during the recession, your office was a real, real help, and Oregonians should be very grateful.
Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Senator Nelson.
Chair, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Randall, for all your good work. So I've just listened to your comments, and, you know, the lottery, and there's sin taxes out there. But actually, you start adding all those things up, they're not really going to answer our problems. Paul Warner and our legislative revenue has given me some figures there. It's about 12 states out of 50 that have surpluses in the United States. Eight of them are on the western states. We're not one of those.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they have a surplus is because they're using their natural resources. Alaska has oil, Montana has coal, Wyoming, New Mexico. Nevada might be a difference, so that's gambling. Maybe we should go to
gambling. We're using everybody's money, yeah.
But my point is that, you know, you as one of the state leaders, you sit on the state lands board, is
right.
That correct? I mean, basically, if we're going to solve this problem in the state of Oregon, if we're going to get back to the point where we have good credit ratings and go on things, we're going to have to go back to our natural resource base. And it's going to be up to the executive branch, which you're a part of, to start promoting that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what are we good at in Oregon? We grow trees. We have water in the Columbia River. We don't use either one of those to the extent that we should. And until we start doing that, we're just going to be a mediocre state. I mean, we're just going to continue to go downhill. That's just a comment. If you want to comment to it, that's good.
Well, Mr. Chairs, Senator Nelson, I concur that one of the things that we got to continue to do to help not only the state's credit, but its long-term economic health is to look at, continue to build those, foster the economic development in the natural advantages that we have. Natural resource industry continues to be, will be, and should be one of the major portions of our economy. We've been fortunate. We've also been able to see technology develop in this state. So I concur that we've got to continue to look at making sure that we have it, the ability to take advantage of a natural resource that we have, that you're saying. As a land board member, we're looking at, for example, the Elliott State Forest, which we oversee. We're going through a process to ensure that we find that balance between managing it for revenue, which I think we're doing, and we're going to look at increasing the harvest level and yet protected species. And I think you're going to see that come out pretty soon, that we're moving in a forward position to help generate more revenue off that forest.
Senator Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates, and I'm sure these comments are directly on bonding and debt issue culture.
Yeah,
exactly.
Good.
Okay.
Of course,
thank you for helping me clarify. Treasurer Edwards, I know you stressed ballot measure 5 and 11, and I assume your point to include the initiative process in general.
Right.
I mean, 5, 11, 44, 47, 50, 66, 99.
There are a lot of numbers, aren't there?
And the point is, and I think your point, is that all of us behind this dais, everyone sitting in the audience today, every Oregonian that voted for two or three of those. I mean, this is a spending issue, not just of the legislature, but of the populace in general. We want certain things. So I just wanted to, that's a comment. I just wanted to make sure that we included all the other costs, and we haven't talked about one dime at 37 yet, really. The other issue, Mr. Chair, is in your history of debt, and I apologize, I was late. If you take that back to 1990, and maybe Laura's going to get into this, but correct me if I'm wrong, but in the 90s, didn't we have $8 or $9 billion worth of total bonded indebtedness?
Let me go back.
And maybe you can just do that in your presentation, or don't answer because I don't deserve an answer because I'm late.
Well, any more questions for the Treasurer before we get off onto that? Go to Dr. Bates and then Senator Gordon.
Here's just a very quick question. We've been looking at tax anticipation notes being presented for some time. It sort of slips under the radar. How long have we been doing that? I know it's been for several bienniums. And what's that cost per biennium in interest?
Sure. Laura, do you want to give the specifics on the numbers? We started and we got the authorization in 2002, and we sold shortly thereafter, I think it was in April of 2002. We've had three issuances.
That's correct. I'll have to get back to you on the actual cost of the borrowing, but what I can tell you is that we were doing interfund borrowing historically in the state, and that borrowing tax exempt in the credit markets was less expensive to us than borrowing from ourselves because we had to charge ourselves a taxable rate. So we've saved anywhere from $5 to $8 million a year by going and doing TANs versus interfund borrowing. But that will get you both the interest rate of both approaches.
The point I'm trying to make is, how long have you been doing this?
Right.
Because to a great degree, it shows we're running it too tight. We haven't got
Right. Our
own line of credit we can call on as revenues come in very, very highly in the spring as we do our income from income tax, and then run out, we have to start borrowing. And that's just poor management of money and cutting our ending balances too short. Mm-hmm.
I agree with that. The size of these borrowings were north of $700 million, so we've done that three times. I can't remember the exact interest costs in each scenario, but there were tens of millions of dollars, roughly. So we'll get you the exact number, but your point's well taken.
Senator Burbank.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and good morning, Treasurer Edwards. Would you please comment on the use of certificates of participation to finance prison construction? And in addition to that, are there any cautions that you would provide or want us to be aware of in that regard in this budget environment?
Sure. Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Gordley, the COP program, I know I'm using an acronym, which is an anathema to some, and I apologize for that, but that's what we tend to know that program by, is a credit which the state pledges the general fund every 2 years against what basically is a bond. It's just a different type of obligation. So when we pay those credits, we're paying it straight out of the general fund. I know Laura's got a slide here that will show you how much the state's issuance of COPs have gone up dramatically, which again goes to Senator Bates's point, that's coming straight out of the general fund, another direct cost. And again, Oregon's program has been well received in the marketplace. The bottom line is, and I think if there's any takeaway here, is every time we issue a bond, it comes straight out of some source of revenue. So it costs something. It's not a zero-sum game. It costs over time. They're a good way to finance projects, but it has also been, and we'll show you in the presentation, how much Measure 11 has cost because of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Treasurer Edwards, it's good seeing you. Let me begin by saying thank you for the tremendous outreach you do to the state of Oregon and in keeping Oregonians informed of the process. We out in the far parts of the state do appreciate that. I want to make sure I encapsulate your comments, and so am I correct in it's my understanding that if we're going to enhance, once again, the credit rating of the state, we need to make sure we have an ending balance. We need to make sure that we have controlled use of our credit. Mm-hmm. We look at a rainy day fund, have a timely intellectual budget process, and we strengthen the economy. Is that encapsulating your comments?
I think that captures most of it. Again, and I can't take away from this economic hardship that Oregon and much of all the states have faced has put an enormous pressure on all credits around the country. California went off the cliff the farthest with this, but they had a bigger house of cards, and then it fell much harder. In fact, Laura just came from California, can maybe give a perspective on that. But the tenets you just laid out basically are what we need to continue to work on. And I would add a tax system, which continues to be something that the tax code and the volatility is something that continues to be a problem in this state.
Thank you. I just wanted to. Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Treasurer Edwards, last session you presented a proposal to the legislature to actually utilize general obligation bonds for some of the state's liabilities. The legislature bought into half of that argument, but not the entire argument. And I think part of it was converting some of, probably some of our certificates of participation, potentially to general obligation bonds, at a time when the interest rates would have been unbelievably low. Do you see any need? I mean, it's a long-term thing, but the provisions in the Oregon Constitution relative to bonding are rather archaic and date back to, well, probably a state, an agrarian state. you have plenty of capability relative to rural electrification. Mm-hmm. But could you see a need to actually revisit the Oregon Constitution in terms of what our bonding authorities actually are so we can best utilize the instruments that would save Oregonians the most dollars when we do have to fund things over a period of time when it does make economic sense to do that?
Sure. Co-chairs, Senator Devlin, Oregon has a provision in it that says the state cannot indebt itself. And so the way we've created bond programs in Oregon have been to amend the Constitution sort of around that to set up full faith and credit bonding programs in the state of Oregon. So we have a numeric soup, if you will, alphabetic soup of different bonding programs in the Constitution. What I proposed last time, and I think long term it does make some sense, it would be to look at the state having one generic general obligation bond, which again you control all the other bonding programs, so that in the future, if future legislatures find a program they want to bond, instead of having to go out and amend the Constitution every time, they would have the lowest cost of borrowing. We've run against that, for example, at Oregon Health Sciences University, when we asked the voters to either do a geo bond and then you set up another type of appropriation credit behind it in case that didn't pass. Well, you had the time and effort and to try to pass that, which it did, by the way, pass. But it was a one-time deal in the Constitution to give authority for really one project. I think long-term it would make some sense to look at that again.
Thank you, Senator. Yes, Representative
Hannah. Co-chairs, Treasurer, you mentioned your relationship with the New York folks and one would suppose somewhat the selling of Oregon from a debt perspective. And if you were talking to them and you were mentioning such items as ending balance and rainy day fund and possibly spending limit or debt reduction, do you have a sense for what their priority would be to improve the bond rating of Oregon given those factors?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Hanna, they don't tell you anything. They will point out what they see are challenges to states, but they will never engage in policy of what they think are top priorities for you. That's not their job. That's our job. And I think what I try to paint a picture here is if you go back 10, 15 years, Oregon has basically backed itself into a corner. And Senator Westland hit on this. If you look at over time, some of the things that the state's being asked to pay for, the system of paying for it, all, and then, of course, the historic recession and crash of the market, all those things came together and drove home a point that Oregon has been asked to be doing a lot of things without the ability to do it. And that, I think, fundamentally has been one of the big concerns in New York. And again, you, there are things that they would like to see the state do. We do now have a rainy day fund, which the voters approved for education, a huge part of the budget. So they see that as a positive. They would like to see, and I know the governor's proposed at some point to having more ending fund balance. I think that's something that's really long-term. We need to be driving towards that. But there's still systemic revenue against budget and need and demand on that revenue that they still see as out of sync.
May I follow up, please? They must deal with municipal effort different than business effort, because every analyst I've ever met is free with advice. They're easy to tell you what they think you ought to be doing. If then they don't really give you that kind of direction or those type of things, what would you think, based on those issues that I mentioned, that might be most important that would improve the credit rating?
Well, I think it's an amalgamation of many things. I think it is obviously trying to get this economy back on track, which much of which is going to happen independent of the state government or federal government. It's going to happen. We do need to be looking at our budgets. I do think that we've got a concern, and as I mentioned before, an imbalance between the demands, and if you're following the K-12 budget, is way out of whack from what is needed in the state, and the revenues and the budget that you have before you. So we've got that imbalance. I think the rainy day portion of this debate is not as big a concern, because Oregon has gone down that path. And I know the Senator Schrader has a bill to try to maybe change that size of that, but the fact is we have one, and that's been an improvement. I do think you need to look more towards some ending balance. Again, this may not be the session to be able to get it, but the driving towards that makes some sense. And I'll also say that I know there's been some interest in the House particularly to try to put a spending cap. They would have a concern about that, because just like they've watched Colorado put themselves in a box, they see Oregon already in that box. So I don't think this is a spending cap environment that would be positively viewed by them.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
Representative. Then I think we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Okay. And Treasurer, I think I'll be a little more blunt. There's been no discussion about the importance of lessening the long-term debt that we face. In the State of the State address, the governor said that we need to conduct ourselves more in line with the families that we represent. And when families are constantly looking at new ways to borrow more money, it's heading toward disaster. When families do better if they can lower their debt so that when crises come, they have some equity that they can draw on. And it's my understanding that there are states that actually do not incur long-term debt, that have to pay as they go. And so I'm just wondering if there will be any discussion about maybe we shouldn't just always look at new ways to get more debt, as if the people that passed the Constitution were just simpletons who didn't understand that there was a reason why they did not want the legislature and the government to have this open checkbook where they can just put the people and the generations to come in long-term debt. For example, borrowing $450 million last session to pay the light bill on long-term debt is something that a business would never do, or a family. You don't borrow money just to keep the doors open, to maintain a lifestyle. And so I just would hope that there would be some discussion about the benefit in being financially sound and not merely looking for ways to increase debt.
Good comment. Affairs would echo that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Again.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah. We'll go back to Laurie's presentation if there's no further questions. I would echo Representative Richardson's comments. I think the graph we have on the overhead here is illustrative of what's happened in the mid-1990s, and we should take heed and be careful what we do.
And just a return to this page, Senator, through the chair to Senator Westland, just to show you the overall balances. As I was saying, general obligation bonds was the primary element in the state's overall debt portfolio through the mid-90s, and then you see a growth in direct revenue bonds as well as appropriation credits. In particular, as I mentioned earlier, the veterans bonds were the primary form of general obligation bonds for many years. That's been paid down in great part. And for the most part, there's been some increase in general obligation bonds, with the large spike that you see coming in by the end of fiscal year 2004 with pension obligation bonds, which refinanced an unfunded liability of PERS.
Lori? I would like to see a breakout on that graph. Also, you know, how much exactly the pension obligation bonds are as the general obligation debt.
Well, I believe we issued just north of $2 billion. But I will get you
a color visual. So that, if you could do that, that would get it to us at your convenience.
That'd be happy
really
to do that.
Because I can get support from Everson. We've 2001, we did a lot of bonding for the university system and some educational things. You're going to be asked to do that again this session. So just to have some perspective, we also retire some debt. And the good news is we're paying off a lot of the veterans' issues. That's gone down a lot. Seems to be at a status quo or stabilization point. So I think we need to get to represent Richardson's point. You need to really understand where we're going. Thank you.
Okay. I was on direct revenue bonds, and I think that's one of the more interesting things to me, is it broke out the different types of the major categories. What I noted was that there was ongoing housing programs, both single-family and mortgage revenue bonds, but those were very much through the 80s and early 90s. You're paying off mortgages about as quickly as we're issuing new bonds. With the introduction of a few different new credits, however, you start seeing a rise, particularly in lottery revenue bonds, which I'll touch on a little bit more in a few moments. The Oregon Economic and Community Development Department has a bond bank program, and then we've begun developing highway user tax bonds as well for transportation. And there has been an increase, as you can note, since the late 90s in the mortgage revenue programs. I would think most of that would be in the single-family area.
Would you go into a little more detail on each of those four, exactly what they represent for the benefit of the members?
Sure. In the case of housing bonds, we have programs for both single-family, first-time homebuyer programs in Housing and Community Development Department, and then we also have various multifamily housing bonds, some of which are insured through HUD, some of which are conduit issues. As I said, I could get you more detail if you'd like to in writing as to dollar amounts, but clearly, that trend has been on the rise. These are all self-supporting to the extent that each program's the revenue streams have to cover the debt service. There's no general fund support for any of these direct revenue bond programs. In the case of the highway user tax bonds, I noted putting this presentation together that we had some highway user tax bonds in the 90s that were paid off, and then the new programs that started in around approximately year 2000, we've been issuing bonds for the last few years, and we now have approximately $500 million, give or take, in highway user tax bonds. There's an authorization from the legislature to issue approximately $1.9 billion over the next decade. We've just begun to sell those bonds. We're still using up the authorizations from the 2000 and 2001 authorizations of OCA. The bond bank program, I'll be very honest with you, I'm fairly new here. As I mentioned, I've been here 4 months, and I haven't had much of a chance to work with it, but my understanding is it's a program to encourage infrastructure development at the local level in Oregon. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, stand to be corrected, that we're primarily using it to fund water and sewer programs for local governments. And again, those revenue streams cover the debt service costs, not something that's coming through the state general fund. And then lastly, the lottery revenue bond program. And if you'll bear with me, I have some slides specifically on lottery revenue bonds.
Representatives.
Yes.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I'm a chart guy as well. And could you give me information on the housing bonds? There's a pretty significant increase. Can you give me information to let me know if that is in line with population increase in the state of Oregon?
I'll be happy to provide you some information after this meeting.
Thank you.
Well, here's history of appropriation credits. And this is primarily in the blue. You see the various certificate of participation programs. Mr. Jeffries from DAS will be talking in more depth in a few moments about how the COP program has grown over the years. But the purple represents Representative Richardson's comment about the $450 million appropriation deficit bond that was done in 2003. So it shows a fairly significant increase in our appropriation credit and the impact, obviously, in annual debt service in the general fund has grown as well.
For members that don't remember or are new, that uses up all the tobacco master settlement monies that we were fortunate enough to accrue due to the diligence of our Attorney General's office for the next 20 years, except for a $25 million increment.
It's 10 years. So,
gives us pause.
It's 10 years.
Was it 10 years? There's a question down here.
I'm sorry.
I believe it's paid off in 2013.
No, Chair, although it does not fit into the rhetoric, you should maybe also remind them that even if we closed down state government, we would have been in a deficit without that money.
Hopefully we'll do it.
Amends our mission.
Right, Senator Winters, do you have
a comment? I just a comment, because I think comment that Senator Devlin made is one that's worthy of note, because that was critical.
We had 3 months to go, I think, in the buying, and that occurred. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Follow up.
How may I help you?
It, just so we can get all of our messages here on the table, it goes to the issue of why we need a larger stability fund.
Sounds excellent. Uh-oh, now we got Senator. This conversation's gone on a little too long.
You reopened the 203 session. You reopened the 203 session.
Argument of the need for a rainy day fund, and I Representative Richardson said that no person in their right mind would not have a savings account to pay for a leaking roof. We had an opportunity in the 1990s to set aside money equal to our current general fund or even half of it. We didn't do it when times were good. Many of us argued that was the time to set the money aside rather than have to borrow, which is a terrible way to have to conduct a day-to-day business. I just wanted to get that out because some of us wanted that rainy day fund. The kicker interfered with that. Now, I know that people think that that's not our money and they want to give it all back, but that's the reason we don't have a rainy day fund. So you can't have it both ways.
I'm sure the Revenue Committee will enjoy discussing this topic.
I know.
Ways and means, we would like to hear more about our debt. Thank you. All right, would you please continue?
Thank you, sir. Just briefly, we have been trying to take advantage in the state of lowering interest rates and refund debt when it becomes available to do on an advanced refunding basis. This chart just gives you a flavor. People have been talking about the historic lows in interest rates, and unfortunately, I've been saying that for about 4 or 5 years. It keeps getting lower. It's hard to believe. But just to let you know, both at the state and local level in the past year, people have been refunding when they can. And you can see the statistics, 43 local government bonds at a savings to taxpayers of $47 million. At the state level, we were able to take advantage in 5 cases where we hadn't already advanced refunded something. Its time came, and we were able to take in about $14 million of savings. I'll very briefly touch on the Debt Policy Advisory Commission's categories of capacity and then let you move on with your agenda for the day. We look at 4 different types of debt. Now, I've shown you them by the categories, but now I'm going to have you look a little differently. What's general fund supported versus lottery revenue bonds, which are not in the general fund, and they're separate capacity calculations. And these are merely guideposts and guidelines. There's nothing written hard that if you go over those numbers or if you stay under them, your credit rating will necessarily change. But I think they're sort of they're good government, good practices types of ratios. We also briefly touch on what the rating agencies look at, which is a little bit broader than just our general fund from our debt capacity and our debt ratios. And finally, the non-tax supported debt that are these conduit programs.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Because I don't know if it was mentioned before. What do the raters, do they look at our initiative process at all and its impact on both our debt and what we do here in Oregon? And if so, how do they look at it?
through the chair. I just can't see your name. I'm so sorry.
Senator Winters.
Senator Winters. Yes, I think as Treasurer Edwards mentioned earlier, there's a variety of factors that go into any credit rating, and the initiative process is one of several factors that have been cited in various rating agency reports to us. Their concern is that we balance our budget, we stabilize our budget, and then another initiative process comes in, and the state has to then address that. And it's not specifically what the initiative processes are at times as much as it is the constant and ongoing challenges to state government to manage itself in a way that allows for good financial management.
Thank you.
Sorry, I wasn't
Very briefly, the various general fund supported debt programs. As the treasurer mentioned, there's a variety of different general obligation bonds under the state constitution, and this shows you that list. We're also including in general fund supported approximately 38% of the pension obligation bonds, which is approximately the portion of the overall state budget that's supported through general fund in terms of that ratio for pension bonds. The balance is through various other departments that are not in the general fund in terms of their pension costs. There are also COPs, primarily for prison, state offices, and other capital projects, and then the appropriation budget deficit bonds, which, as was mentioned, are being repaid through use of the tobacco settlement revenues.
I just went out to members, this is our part of our zero-sum game. So when your favorite entity comes to you and just wants to do some bonding, doesn't want to really spend any general funds, they just want to do some bonding, you whip this slide out. Please show that to the offending party that comes to your office. If they're from any one of these areas, they're costing the state taxpayers money. It comes out of either public safety, human services, or your education system. So just a note.
I hope this isn't a redundant slide, but just very briefly, as I mentioned, the pension obligation bonds were used to fund the unfunded liability of PERS. We did this because we were able to take advantage of historically low interest rates. The UAL needed to be funded at an 8% rate of return. We were able to go into the credit markets, even though these were taxable bonds rather than tax-exempt. We're able to get a long-term rate of 5.8%, and that savings will be realized because the savings were taken over time and will amount to $900 million over the next 20 years. However, I think it's important to note when I show you these debt ratios that it was a cost of state government to pay for the unfunded liability. Mm-hmm. But what it does, is, as you'll see in the next few slides, mm-hmm. it drives up our debt ratios because now we're accounting for it on this side of the balance sheet rather than the other side. So I'm going to be showing you slides both with and without the pension bond so you can see how the ratios have changed. Again, briefly, this is just the general fund supported debt. You see that for many years, we stayed just under $1 billion in general fund supported debt, and the large rises in the last few years. When we calculate the debt service ratios, we simply look at debt service outstanding on bonds, dividing by the available resources, which in this case we use the December 2004 general fund revenue forecast to develop our ratios. Our current ratio, we forecast for the end of this fiscal year, will be 3.78%, and that does include the 38% pension obligation bonds. Then we forecast forward. We don't make predictions as to how much capacity should be used, but the Debt Policy Commission says what is the most debt that could be issued where we would stay under the 5%. What you see is we have just over about $1 billion over the next four fiscal years in terms of capacity if we were to stay within that target. Not, again, that you should necessarily issue that much, but just to give you a sense of scale.
And those numbers are somewhat arbitrary that are filled in for 06, 07, 08. They could be.
We just max it out each year just to show you that you could issue much less and keep the ratios lower. But if you go above those numbers, you break the barrier because we're paying off debt as well, and revenues is forecast to grow as well.
Yeah, and then are you compounding those projections? So, I mean, are you assuming that $653 million in the 2007?
Yes. Yes, we are. Because we are paying off debt along the way, so that provides some additional capacity. Lottery bonds. Very briefly, there's been 15 lottery bond revenue sales thus far. Currently outstanding is $594 million. And you can see there's a wide range of programs that lottery revenue bonds have been used for over the last several years. At first, the program started fairly slow in the early 90s, and you can see that in the last several years, it's become a large source of funding for capital projects in the state, and Greg will be speaking about some of the details of that in a few minutes. We had, up till recently, been using a 15-year payback program, which allowed debt to roll off fairly quickly, and that's why things seem to stabilize, even though we are continuing to issue debt in this area. We did the same calculation, slightly different. In our bond indenture, we have a 4x coverage for factor. So after we take to the side the cost of operating the lottery and some set-asides that have been built into state law, we take all of the revenues that are remaining and we divide by 4, and then we forecast what that debt service would mean in terms of additional debt capacity. And this is our forecast in the same fashion, a maximum capacity of $570 million in 4 years.
Thank you, Coach. I guess I need a little 101 question here. On the 15-year payback, does that mean that when we take out a bond, the term of that is 15 years?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
One last quick question.
Please follow me.
In these 15 lottery revenue bond program sales, I can see where some of these assets would have a useful life more than 15 years, but I'm questioning some of these others and wondering if the assets or the programs financed do indeed have a useful life more than 15 years, or were we financing assets or programs or services that perhaps had a useful life of 3 years and yet we're paying them over 15?
Through the chair, Representative Smith, I believe when the program started, it was one of the first in the United States, and it had less to do with the useful life of the asset and more what investors were willing to buy. There was an uncertainty as to whether the lottery would continue to generate enough revenues to continue to pay the debt service for these bonds. And so they chose to keep it relatively short because from an investor perspective, you could sort of see out 10 to 15 years that the lottery might go, but whether it would still be there in 20 years. We are proposing moving towards 20-year lottery revenue bonds. It's been done in Florida, and there seems to be investor willingness to go that far out and to buy our bonds. So it's really not about the useful life of the asset so much as it is a marketing decision.
Okay, well, let me rephrase my question just real quick. Are we paying off bonds today for things that we no longer use?
I don't believe that's the case. These are long-term assets of the state, including like the West Side Rail, and Greg can list many of the other projects. So these are things that are permanent assets of the state. It's lottery revenue bonds are really a financing technique, and the investor who's buying that bond is not getting the general fund credit of the state. The only source of repayment is a stream of lottery revenue that will be coming in over time.
Thank you.
Good questions, actually.
Mr. Chairman, I could probably. We actually did, because part of the packages when we were first in the legislature, Mr. Co-Chair speaking as the Senate Co-Chair, part of the packages for K-12 in terms of technology, I think, were lottery bonds, and you can assume in many of those cases that those assets are beyond their useful life already. So.
Okay.
No, we did it.
Just to conclude then, based on moving to a 20-year term rather than 15 years, at the 4x coverage, we forecast $571 million in additional capacity, staying below those the 4x coverage factor based on current forecasts of lottery revenue. I think it's important to point out that this forecast did not include any proposed change to the lottery program for line games. And if that were to pass, then we would need to recalculate and give you a new capacity target.
So we're over the target right now, is what you're telling us.
No, we have more coverage. In other words, this is a little bit different. We have 6x coverage, which means it's a slightly different than a ratio because it's divide the amount of revenue by 4. And so we have way more revenue. So we do have some capacity in that regard. As I said briefly, the rating agencies look at our debt and they go beyond what's just our general fund and they say if there's tax-supported, they look at all of our tax-supported debt here in Oregon because they're looking at us compared to all the other states, and every state has a slightly different way of allocating and chopping up all the different tax streams. So to look at our ratios compared to our peer group, we take all of our general fund-supported debt plus the balance of our pension obligation bonds, our lottery revenue bonds, and our highway user taxes bonds, and they take that total package as the comparison vehicle. They crunch the numbers the same way, and they just compare state to state. And what you see is there has been an increase, fairly significant, in the amount of net tax-supported debt in the last three fiscal years. And you can see that that rolls out to higher debt per capita and debt as a percentage of personal income. If you back off the pension obligations, however, I think that's a very important thing. As I mentioned, the state was paying unfunded liability on one part of its balance sheet. Some states have not chosen to do pension obligation bonds. They still may carry large unfunded liabilities in their balance sheets. And so in order to really compare apples to apples, you need to not include the pension obligation bonds. And there you see that our debt ratios have gone up slightly, but for the most part, with some slight rise, personal income has grown, maybe not as much as we'd like, but it has more or less kept up with our debt ratios. And they still see us net of our pension obligation bonds as having very moderate, low to moderate debt ratios. 5% is sort of the standard rule of thumb, if you will, in terms of looking at these statistics.
Do the markets then take that into account? You're pointing this out that, you know, outside of the pension obligation bonds, it would appear that our net tax supported debt has been pretty consistent and continues to be pretty consistent.
Yes, I think they do.
You that the markets also look at that and take that into account.
Yes, they do.
I think it's important for us to know, because if you look at the census spending data, you'll see we used to be, quote, a low debt state on net tax supported, you know, bottom 10 states or even bottom 5 states. Now we're in the middle of the pack. But from what I'm hearing from Lori, when we read that data, we'll know it's because of these pension obligation bonds, not necessarily because we've gone crazy with
through the chair, I agree. And the challenge, I've worked in other states. I worked in Virginia for a few years and did a debt capacity report there many years ago. The challenge is finding the right ratio or the right blend of debt, because you need to invest in your state for economic development for the citizenry. And keeping in balance, I think it's important to have a good long-term capital plan and to have generally have a plan. And if you're issuing debt just to balance budgets, that's not usually a good thing from a credit perspective. But I've seen the rating agencies be very comfortable with relatively high debt ratios to other states, because they also understood that the state had a capital plan that was built around their longer economic development needs. So this is really more art than science.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Bates?
Just a little more discussion on the pension obligation bonds. My memory of this, and correct me, it may well be wrong, is that some states just carry this on their books, and sooner or later they're going to have to pay the price for doing it. They're going to have to somehow raise the funds to cover the obligations they have in the future for their pension plans. Our state is elected to do this, float bonds for it, but that money then was reinvested, I believe. And my understanding is, correct me again if I'm wrong, that we actually, because we were wise enough at a time when the market was extremely low for obligation bonds, we got these at a very low rate, long term, and the reinvestment in that is actually producing more than what we're paying for those bonds, so that not only are we taking care of our obligation in the future, but we're probably reducing that obligation by the interest we're gaining. Is that a correct statement?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Bates. That's my understanding. We chose to issue bonds at very low interest rates and taxable market. The stock market has picked up subsequent to the sale of those bonds, and I'm not the expert on PERS, but I do believe that PERS has beat their actuarial required rate of 8% in both the last 2 years.
Is that a follow-up, Mr. Chair? Well, Mr. Chair, does that in essence reduce our potentially reduce our PERS our PERS risk and our PERS needs in the next 20 years?
Through the chair, Senator, I'm probably not the person to ask that question to. You should probably talk to the PERS folks. Unfortunately, with pension obligation bonds, you've got to wait till that whole 20-year period is over, because there's going to be some good years and some bad years. So generally speaking, it's certainly a good thing that we've been doing well, but there could be some bad years and good years over the next 20 years. And at the end of the whole thing, then we'll know for certain that it was a wise move. Clearly, it was wise for us to lower our interest costs from 8% to 5.8% to fund the unfunded portion of the state's liability with pensions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you produce a balance sheet for the state of Oregon that, so it would be understandable to us?
We could have that.
Through the chair, again, I have to smile and defer to the Department of Administrative Services that is in charge of doing things like that. I'm simply the state's debt manager.
There is a balance sheet available.
There is a balance sheet available. I'm just wondering.
I'll give you a little cover. Thanks again.
Just quickly wrap up my presentation. As I mentioned earlier, there's a variety of conduit bond programs and direct revenue bond programs in the state that require no tax support. They're all based on program revenues. Each of those programs does forecasts of their cash flows. The State Treasurer's Office reviews those cash flows before we sell bonds for any particular series. And you can see there's a wide array of programs that the State Treasurer's Office works with in various state agencies. That's my conclusion is simply that our debt burden has increased significantly in the last few years, and that trend will most likely continue to occur in the next several biennia, particularly because of the authorization for transportation bonds. If we did nothing else, there'll be an increase in our debt ratios as that those bonds are sold over the next few years. There is still significant debt capacity to meet capital needs, although it's becoming a scarcer resource and should be, I would hope, carefully considered in how we effectively allocate that to the most worthy and beneficial programs. We can issue up to $1 billion, theoretically, and stay within the 5% target for general fund supported debt over the next 4 years. And we have additional debt capacity of $571 million in lottery revenue bonds. Finally, in my brief time, I can assure you that as I've gone through and learned more about the various bonding programs based on my own experience, that the state debt programs are very well managed universally through all the various state agencies I've worked with. It's been my pleasure to get to know some of the finance officers in the various state agencies who work about in the debt area, and I think the state's well positioned moving out of this recession to continue to manage its debt in a very prudent way.
If you came from any other state than California, I'd say there'd be high purchase. I'm not sure.
I worked at a local level in California. I was at the bottom of the financial food chain. So.
Mr. Co-Chair, I have a question. Something you said earlier was that we're still issuing transportation bonds based on an authorization from, I think you said, 2000 or 2001?
I believe the 2003 legislature, if I'm not mistaken.
2003? So are we talking about OTIA 3?
Yes, sir.
Okay, because I thought you may have been saying that there was a prior authorization that we haven't even finished.
We just finished OTIA 1 and 2. We've just completed issuing most of the bond authorizations under OTIA 1 and 2, which I think were approximately 2000 and 2001. Those authorizations.
And so we haven't started yet borrowing against OTIA 3?
Not to my knowledge, but I can double check, sir.
So all those jobs you created? Did you really create any jobs?
through the chair, we just did a refunding this past month of some ODOT of debt. They have been spending money towards those programs. We haven't quite yet wrapped up and sold bonds to reimburse ourselves for that particular series. We will in the next year or so. When we're forecasting for the rating agency purposes, just, I don't have the exact numbers, but approximately $300 million each year for the next 3 years. Those numbers will most likely vary slightly, but just looking at the authorization and the time frames, that is the ballpark estimate that we gave the agencies at this point. But I hope to learn more about OTIA programs and be able to come back to you with more hard numbers in the near future.
It would be a good thing for the transportation subcommittee to really follow up on. I think, God forbid, we have another recession, but why we do things and how we bill why we're doing things in the middle of a recession, we ought to look at this as an example of, are we really creating what we think we're creating in a timely, as timely manner as we can, certainly, but
you are.
Yeah. Question, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From a cash flow perspective, there seems to be some significant incongruity with the general fund-supported debt capacity increasing of $1 billion, when it would appear to me that quite clearly we're structurally out of balance in terms of our general fund-supported programs and the resources available to pay for those programs. And how would you bring those two together and justify additional debt to the extent that we can't support the basic institutions that we currently have and the expectations of voters to support those.
Through the chair to Senator Morris. I neither justify nor recommend that we use up the debt capacity of the state. The Debt Policy Advisory Commission's job under state statute is simply to do a forecast of available capacity, and it's really the legislature's decision as to how to use that debt capacity or whether to use it at all.
Just for a graphic representation to follow up on Senator Morris, it'd be really interesting to know what the debt service on $1 billion in general fund supported debt, what the debt service would be on lottery revenues for $571 million in addition to that capacity.
And I can get that for you. I just don't have it with me in my briefcase.
Good point. Good question. Thank you. Very good presentation. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
$450 million, roughly.
Come on, Mr. Jeffries. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My name is Greg Jeffrey. I'm the finance manager with the Department of Administrative Services. This material, I believe, has been distributed to each of the committee members. In the interest of time, I'll go through and highlight a couple of issues. What it addresses is more or less the history of Oregon's use of certificates of participation and also lottery revenue bonds. And so with that, I'll just begin with the history. Certificates of participation were authorized in the state of Oregon by the 1989 legislature. They were almost immediately challenged in the Oregon Supreme Court. In December of that year, the court validated the state's use of Oregon's certificates of participation, you know, as they were structured, you know, and authorized within state law. There's been a little bit of discussion about general obligation bonds relative to the cost of them, relative to the cost of certificates of participation. You know, on this sheet, what we've included is a comparison, you know, of issuing a 20-year, $100 million general obligation bond compared to the cost of a COP, so that it can give you some information about what that compared cost is. Oregon really has some very strong controls over the way that certificates of participation are used in the state. You know, very simply, it's a four-step process. The first step starts with the Department of Administrative Services budget instructions. As part of the instructions, we ask each agency to identify their finance request for the upcoming biennia. Those requests are analyzed relative to the mission of the agency, the source of funds for repayment, you know, particularly what the requested use is, you know, of the COPs. That is the elements that are, make it through that process are incorporated into the governor's recommended budget. It goes through the legislative budget review process. Once that individual state agency review process is completed, the legislature gets another look, you know, at the total amount of COPs by looking at what Oregon calls the bond bill, which is generally looked at later in the session. And it gives, again, the legislature a chance to have a comprehensive look at the total amount, you know, not the project-by-project COP authorization that had been reviewed in each individual agency's budget, but the total amount of COPs that adds up to, and also relative to the total amount of general obligation bonds, lottery revenue bonds. So it's a very good process that the state has. And then the final step is before any COPs are issued, both the DAS director and the state treasurer have to approve, you know, that issuance. And so it gives another check, you know, that things that may have happened during the interim that may produce some reason why that project perhaps shouldn't go forward, that can be addressed at that time. Oregon's been very selective in the way that it's used COPs. On page 3 of this handout, it highlights, you know, how the what agencies, for what agencies COPs have been used for since the program started in 1990. And of the total, about 64% of the COPs have been used for public safety institutions, primarily for the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority. The next largest user has been the Department of Administrative Services. Primarily, it's been office buildings and the way it's been used there. And when we're talking about that, we're talking about the Portland State Office Building, the Human Resources Building here in Salem, the Public Utility Commission Building here in Salem. There was a major remodel of the Public Service Building. There's a number of projects that's the way that it has been used. As of the end of December of last year, there's a total outstanding COPs of just under $850 million. I won't go over again some of the capacity issues that Laura touched on very clearly. But really, I think in light of some of the earlier discussions and questions that the committee members had, it would probably be good to look at, again, if you look at Exhibit A here, there's a very brief layout of the four-step approval process that COPs follow through the course of the budget review. And then the first chart that follows that shows all of the COPs that are outstanding. And if you look, and clearly public safety, you know, has been the primary source of the purposes for which certificates of participation have been issued.
Question, Senator Wayne.
Do you have a graph to show, you know, in public safety, the bulk of those were done following Measure 11, I'm assuming, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I'll show you two charts down, okay. You know, if you want to look at that. If you look at this chart, it shows each biennia how many COPs have been used and the major projects that they were used to finance. And it's a very interesting history, you know, that follows the state of Oregon's history. If you look at the first biennia there with $144 million in COPs, it's at the lower part of the graph. Again, that was the first time that COPs were authorized. Primarily what it was a catch-up, you know, in state office buildings. I mentioned these projects earlier, the Portland State Office Building, Human Resources Building. Well, about just beyond halfway through that biennium, Measure 5 passed in November of 1990. And so you can see in the subsequent two biennia, there was a significant slowdown, you know, in the level of COPs that had been used. In fact, there was a moratorium, you know, on the issuance of debt back at that time. If you look at the 1995-97 biennia, well, in November of 04, Measure 11 passed. And you can look in the 95-97, the major projects that got funded were the Snake River Prison facility, Umatilla medium security prison. The Senate Bill 1145 reference was a measure that was passed in the 95 session, which authorized the issuance of up to about $93 million in state COPs to finance added county correctional capacity in exchange for the transfer of responsibilities for inmate management for felons sentenced to 1 year or less. And then you can just follow the additional uses of COPs up to where we are right now.
Very good. I like that graph. Representative
Smith. Thank you, Co-Chair. When the major prison construction projects were underway, facilities were built throughout the state, and some of those today have been shut down and are no longer in use. Is it my understanding from looking at this then that we're still paying debt on those
facilities, even though they're not being used.
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Smith, all of the state adult prison facilities are that have any COPs, utilized to construct are operating.
How about
I do believe that there had been, I think three or perhaps four, of the OYA facilities that had been partially or totally shut down. But the state is continuing to pay the debt service on those COPs. That's correct. Those OYA facilities were, in every case with COPs, this issue came up earlier. We structure the term of the repayment to fit with the useful life of the facility. So when we go out with IT projects, our policy is that it's repaid over between 5 and 7 years. In the OYA case, it was scheduled for repayment over 12 years. Those were issued in 1996. So those will be, fully repaid, in the relatively near term. With the state prison facilities, they're generally financed over a 25-year term. Again, these are facilities that, are expected to have a useful life of 40 to 50 years.
Okay. I think there's two OYA facilities that are closed. Senator Winter, Senator Devlin, Senator Morris, and then Senator Morsett.
Question. I know that it's structured around the length of the usefulness of the facility, but isn't a part of the of COPs where if we no longer use or want to use, that it can revert back to the builder? Isn't your contract set up?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, the way that COPs, when the Supreme Court decided, they validated the structure of the Oregon COPs, technically they determined that the COPs for Oregon are not debt because the legislature that authorized a particular series of COPs has not bound subsequent legislatures to pay the debt service, on that particular COP. That's why it's referred to as an appropriation credit, and because it's every 2 years subject to an appropriation, which is why the market out there is looking at how essential, are these facilities that a particular entity is using COPs to finance. What is the likelihood that the state, is going to deliberately decide, not to pay the debt service that's scheduled, and therefore, not have the access and the utilization of this particular facility. The way that the COP program is structured is that, and it sounds complicated, I guess because it is, but when the state constructed, let's say, the Snake River Prison, we're entitled, the state owns it, we're not selling a mortgage, on it. However, what we are doing is we're leasing it to the trustee during the term of the COP repayment, and they are subletting it back to the state for that same term, so that so long as the state is making its payments, as scheduled, that sublease is maintained, and our right to utilize it survives. If, in fact, the state fails to make its payment, those are terms for that sublease to be terminated, they continue to have the right under the lease, to utilize it. And it's their responsibility to protect the COP holders out in the world to look for an alternative tenant to generate revenues to the extent as possible, replace, those COP payments that had been denied, by a subsequent legislature.
That's the essence of because if this body does not authorize the payments, it then those how you stated what occurs under the the lease agreements, and I don't think most members know that that's how these are, operate out there in the real world, that the person who is really on the hook is our relationship with the builder or this body who's out there putting up the money, and we've agreed that we'll lease it from you and we'll pay it back.
I didn't mention, of course, there would certainly be rating, you know, implications, significant ones, if the state were to choose that.
But as I understand the discussion back when this came up, that, you know, there were some who saw this, and that's why it went to court as a backdoor way of doing indebtedness and bonding, coming up with this kind of creative financing, if you will.
Senator Devlin.
I just wanted to clarify the OYA situation. During the special sessions, we closed 4 out of 5 new OYA facilities. 2 of them are partially reopened and are now operating. 1 has control that has been given over to the National Guard in Central Oregon, and I believe the final one is still being partially used by Linn County, and we were hoping to reopen it this biennium, but it is not included in the governor's budget to reopen it partially.
Thank you, Mr. Public Safety. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a follow-up to Representative Smith's question, do we have 1145 facilities that are either substantially underutilized or are not being utilized?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Appreciate that.
Yes.
Co-chairs, Senator Morris, I don't know. You'd need to talk to Department of Corrections.
I believe we do. But we'll have
I can speak to
great topic for the public safety subcommittee.
Depends on the operating cost.
Senator Morissette.
Well, I want to raise the question of why the OI facilities are not being fully utilized.
Didn't have the money company.
We don't
money.
Have operating.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator, that's what I understand to be the
so
case.
The taxpayers are not willing to provide the money to operate the facilities that they bond for, and then they blame somebody for bonding for that facility. The game doesn't have both ways. You either got to pay for both of them or none of them.
I guess
Senator Carter.
The Treasurer's Office is looking at you because it's the responsibility of the legislature that when we get information from these initiatives about, you know, how much we go out for bonding to build new prisons, if we don't put the facilities management piece of that in there, then we lose out in trying to find the money for doing so. So it's the legislature's responsibility. So you were talking to the rest of us instead of Treasurer Off. I know you were, Senator Morris.
I'm talking to the voters of Oregon.
Oh, okay. I thought so.
That's what I was talking about. We try to do it, and they say, no, we don't want new taxes. So that's why we have the dilemma. The legislator did it.
Not a part of the consultation question.
My final point on COPs, unless there are more questions, would be just to back up one chart from the page we were just on. And what that lays out is the 0507 COP authorization request. And as you can see, again, public safety institutions is the lion's share of that request. The committee will ultimately, the two projects that's, you know, referring to would be an expansion to the Coffee Creek facility and also the beginning, you know, of the actual construction of the Madras medium security prison.
What's the debt service associated with these projects, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Co-Chair, I don't have that information with me. I can certainly provide you with that.
I think members would be interested. Thank
certainly.
I think that's a significant issue, Mr. Co-Chair, that the implications to the budgets that we're going to be dealing with, this is a chunk of money that's pretty much committed.
All righty.
Mr. Chair, then, just to continue, the lottery program, again, the history, it was started in 1993. The first project, as Laura mentioned earlier, was the Westside Light Rail. It provided the state's portion of matching funds for that project to go forward. It was the first lottery revenue bond to be issued in the states. To follow that, then, the 1997 session decided to begin the lottery revenue bond program. Initially, there were three purposes for which it was authorized. The one was to raise $150 million for a menu of potential uses of those funds for K-12, you know, system throughout the state. That authorization was put before the voters and authorized, you know, by the voters. The other two purposes were to establish an authority to, over a period of time, raise funds to make improvements to Oregon State Parks, and in the upcoming biennia at that time to authorize just $15 million, you know, as the first kind of payment, you know, on that long-range upgrade plan. And then the third project was to raise $6 million in matching funds for clean drinking water grants that economic development, grants and loans that economic development was providing to local jurisdictions throughout the state. Since that time, since 1997, there's been a total of $638 million in lottery revenue bonds issued. For the biennium that we're in right now, the legislature had authorized up to $132 million in lottery bonds to be issued. We've issued about $40 million of them earlier in the biennium. We're now on the schedule to issue another 38 later in the month of February. Just to note a couple of the characteristics of Oregon lottery bonds. As Laura mentioned earlier, what constitutes the character of lottery bond or revenue bonds is the pledge of a specific stream of revenues, you know, as being the first, you know, use of that revenue is for the purpose of paying debt service, you know, on the lottery bonds issued against those. In Oregon, Oregon has taken, well, when the program was started, there was a very very positive, organized effort led by Treasury to make it the strongest credit that we could and therefore get the lowest cost of capital. One of the enhancements that were added, which was a very strong one, is that in the Oregon Constitution there's a requirement that the first use of lottery revenues needs to go first and foremost to pay any outstanding, you know, lottery bond debt service. And so before any of the other lottery revenues that are available for any other purpose can be distributed, first we need to fund our debt service schedule that's scheduled for that particular point in time. The other enhancements about the program are the fact that we cannot issue additional lottery bonds unless our recent history of lottery revenues that are pledged are 400%, you know, of what the debt service is on the outstanding lottery bonds plus the debt service on the anticipated lottery bonds. The Department of Administrative Services needs to certify that that is the case, you know, before every new lottery bond is issued. Laura talked a little earlier about what the remaining capacity is, and then just to talk to about what is being requested in lottery revenue bonds in the 2005-2007 period. There are three purposes for which it is being requested. The total amount is about $202 million. The first purpose is to raise about $60 million for economic development, which would provide infrastructure related to the preparing shovel-ready industrial sites, you know, throughout the state. The second purpose would be to raise $100 million for investment in multimodal system improvements throughout the state, which would be in the air, rail, water, transportation modes. And then the final request is to raise just under $20 million and use that to make capital improvements required because of deferred maintenance on the university system facilities. The system of higher education has identified consistently each biennia a growing, backlog of projects that are a result of deferred maintenance. And currently it's somewhere between $500 and $600 million. This would be an effort to begin to work on that. The last two charts highlight what of the outstanding COPs, what purpose they had originally been used for. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry, lottery bonds. The last chart highlights the three purposes for which there is a request for lottery bonds to be issued in 05-07. And then finally, on your package, there's a register broken down by biennium for each project that lottery bonds have been issued by the state of Oregon.
Can you give us the debt service again for the lottery bond totals? I mean, we're all going to see this in our separate subcommittees, but it would be nice for us to get have the big picture as we go through our individual subcommittees.
I don't have the specific debt service, for the lottery bonds, but I can certainly put that together for you, Mr. Chair. Mr.
Coach. I like that last chart. That's very illustrative. Yes, Senator Morsett.
Thank you. As a matter of, I guess, good budgeting practices, a bonding is not a good idea for operations. And my question is, and I don't remember what that money for K-12, I think remember it being an operation.
It was operations, yes.
Yeah, part of it was technical.
So I guess what I'm saying is that it's, we have to be very careful. There's a temptation to backfill operations with bonding, but that's not a good use of bonding because it's a black hole. You never can put enough into operations and bonding. And so I just wanted to say that.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Fields, or Morissette, I'm sorry. As an informal policy, that is what the state tries to follow, is that COPs, lottery revenue bonds, are not issued to pay operating costs.
Yeah.
And in the case of the K-12, as I mentioned earlier, there was a laundry list, of things that the K-12 system could utilize the dollars for, which included repairs of existing facilities. But when you crept up on the list, there were things that were clearly not, capital. There wasn't an accountability required of the K-12 folks as to specifically how the dollars were used.
That's a good point to be made. Representative Morgan.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is just a point of personal clarification. In addition to the request for OUS for lottery bonds for ongoing maintenance issues, they also have a request in for capital construction, as do the community colleges. My understanding is that those are general obligation bonds and not backed by the lottery, but backed by the general fund.
I think that
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, that's correct. The only authorization in the Oregon Constitution for the state to use general obligation bonds for specific, capital projects is Article 11G and Article 11F, which are both for higher education, facilities. Under 11G, what is required is that the bonds can only be issued to pay 50%, of the capital costs. Another source of what was anticipated was general fund, would be utilized, to pay the other 50%. In fact, what has happened over the years is that it's generally paid with federal grants, donations, gifts that the university system, has raised. In the 11F authorization, which is really more for kind of ancillary, facilities like dormitories, and which would follow, the requirement in that instance, which requires that it be totally self-supporting. So no general fund is used to pay debt service on the higher ed 11F bonds. In the G bonds, on the portion that is financed using 11G bonds, general fund, you know, is used to pay the debt service on that.
Thank you. Follow-up comment,
please,
Mr.
Coacher.
The F bonds are, in my recollection, funded from a revenue stream that's created by what's being built. So if you're building a cafeteria, the proceeds of food service will be the revenue stream to pay back the bonds. If you're building a dormitory, it's the cost that students pay to rent the rooms that are the revenue stream. And I appreciate the clarity of that. I think that the larger point here for the Ways and Means Committee people is to be aware that there are a number of pulls on general fund revenue and indebtedness from a lot of different directions because of these capital projects that we get involved in, and it's, I think, a challenge to get a look at the breadth of the indebtedness from these kinds of programs, and it's quite stunning when you actually get the whole thing laid out.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could add to that, you might recall that in, I think it was in 2002, where Measure 11, or Measure 15 and 16 were passed, which established new general obligation authorizations in the Constitution to do seismic, you know, rehabilitations, mm-hmm. you know, of the one measure was for educational facilities, the other measure would be for public safety and emergency, you know, facilities. Now, this legislature hasn't implemented, you know, any implementing legislation to establish those. But again, that measure mentioned nothing, you know, of sources of repayment, you know, in the event a program did get established. And I believe, you know, Representative, again, that I think that's one of the values that the State Debt Advisory Commission, you know, has been able to provide, you know, to the governor and the legislature, you know, which is to bring focus, you know, to the limited, you know, and the difficult decisions, you know, that it comes to making choices, you know, about which are the best ways, you know, to utilize limited resources.
Representative Wisnett, then Senator Morse.
Thank you, Co-Chair. In your paper, you mentioned the reserve account, that 10% of each bond goes into a reserve account. So if we spent $638 million, I would assume about $100 million is in that account. Who manages that? Who decides on that? Is that established by statute? Will we see that as a budget item, or will it be in the budget, just identifying that that's reserve money?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Mr. Representative Wisner, that reserve account, it is a requirement generally of the public finance market for a revenue bond. The reasoning there is that if that revenue stream were to be interrupted, that there was an immediately available resources available to provide a buffer of time for the issuer, you know, to look at reestablishing, you know, that revenue stream to carry on, you know, with the payment. In effect, the reserve is, for the lottery revenue bond program, the reserves have never been utilized. What happens is that we manage the lottery revenue bond. In every case, we enter into a guaranteed investment contract for the full term of the repayment, which up to now has been 15 years. And in every case, that investment agreement has produced a yield in excess of the cost of the bonds. So except for the federal rebate, you know, requirements that kind of overlay that, you know, somewhat, for the most part, those reserves are paying for themselves. Based on their earnings, and then exactly they're used to make, you know, all or the large portion of the final payment when the bonds are repaid.
Follow up. So there's not an extra revenue source there that, you know, that if you, I understand you have to maintain a reserve to keep the rate and get the money, but if you're creating interest, there's not an extra, you're using that to make the final payment.
Well, there were said.
Thank you. I want to go back to maintenance and bonding. What happened, I sat through a three-hour meeting at one of my school districts, Pleasant Hill. They were trying to decide whether or not they would have to consolidate with another school district because they couldn't afford the teacher, they couldn't afford to keep their school open. The ultimate decision was to bond to do the maintenance rather than taking that out of their operations, which they, under normal times, would have. So I'm wondering if, you know, that's a way around the bonding, maybe. It isn't. Okay. Deferred maintenance is not an excuse for bonding, right?
Well, Mr. Co-Chairs and Senator Morissette, I think that deferred maintenance, the way that I understand it, is that, let's say your automobile, you know, you don't change the oil in your automobile for 3 years running, you know. So you've deferred, you know, assuming the responsibility to change that oil. 3 years down, you need to buy a new engine, you know, because your oil or your engine has seized up. Well, buying that engine is a capital cost, and it's a direct result of that deferred maintenance responsibility, you know, over those 3 years. And that's what higher ed is talking about. The projects that will be addressed in that $19 million in lottery bonds are primarily power plants on these universities, you know, that need to be substantially upgraded as a result, you know, of a failure to make, you know, regular investments, you know, in them over time.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson, then we'll move on.
My question was already answered through the representative.
Very good. Good questions. This is important for members to get comfortable with, is that, believe it or not, we didn't have any attention paid to this back in the early 80s and what happened. Then we had some crises and people got very nervous. And we were very afraid of all debt and everything at that point in time, and the pendulum swinging a little bit the other way. But this is the opportunity for thoughtful discourse, so I appreciate the good quality of the questions and the testimony we've had. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And hopefully indulgence of Mr. Hartwig and Mr. Petty. I'm going to turn it over to my fellow co-chair, because I have, unfortunately, been summoned. So, to be for it.
Good morning.
And just as a time note, I mean, we're looking still to get out of here at 10:30. Our apologies that we've had to go over time on the previous presentation, but I appreciate your indulgence on that. And just at your presentation, if I can ask the members to hold off at least for the next 10-15 minutes and give you an opportunity to make that presentation, and then we'll take questions at the final few minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for having me. My name for the record is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the State Services Division in the Department of Administrative Services. Staff is passing out a presentation. It's a little longer than the time frame, so I'll beg your indulgence as I will move through it at a pretty fast pace, and then as I get towards the end, there'll be time for some questions, hopefully. So let's get started. On page one, the topics that I wanted to cover in this overview are procurement authority, which I think is, what authority do we have to do this? And I think authority is really fundamental to any discussion of an overview of procurement. The application of the public contracting code, the procurement and contracting rules, talk generally about the five basic types of contracts. What are the methods of source selection that public agencies use when they acquire products and services? Brief overview of the preferences that are involved in statute. Some discussion of controls and oversight, both by the Department of Justice and DAS. I've got a profile of personal services contracts, which gives you some sense of where spending goes as it relates to personal services. And then I'd like to talk about two major initiatives that we have going on, strategic sourcing and the new Oregon Procurement Information Network, or electronic procurement. If you turn to page two, quickly, all the authority in DAS and authority for state agencies, at least for most state agencies, goes back to ORS 279, which was rewritten during the last session and is Oregon's public contracting code. It sets out procurement policy, and it establishes ways and means for procurement. It has a new protest process, which is new to it, and generally it treats public agencies, state and local governments the same way, although there are some exceptions. Generally, the legislature has been more prescriptive about state agency spending as it relates to personal services contracts. And another fundamental difference is that for public agencies, local governments, it establishes a contract review board, which sets authority for those, for your counties and cities. That's vested in the Department of Administrative Services through the Director of DAS for state agencies under DAS authority. The rewrite to ORS 279 broke it into three different areas, and it's I think it's important to understand that 279A is the overview on page 2 if you're just now getting the presentation. 279A in the new statute is really the overarching general provisions of the new statute that apply to everything under 279. 279B directs procurements for everything other than construction contracts and A&E services. And then 279C provides guidance for public improvement, construction contracts, and A&E services. So there's a recognition in the statute that trying to treat all procurements the same way just really didn't make sense with respect to construction and other types of procurement. Let's turn to page 3. This talks about the DAS authority. Currently under existing statute, that is under 712, and it gives DAS the authority to purchase all supplies and services on behalf of state agencies. And that has been changed in a new law. It's essentially the same, but it's got two new statutory sites. DAS shall conduct all procurements and administer contracting for goods, services, and personal services for state agencies. So I'll move past that and move to page 4. It talks about the application of 279, and I think this is interesting because oftentimes people have an idea that 279 guides all procurement activities of any state agencies. But when you begin to look at it in a little more depth, you see that it's actually not that case. 279 governs DAS procurement authority. It governs authority by the Secretary of State. It governs authority by the State Treasurer. And then also, in 279A025, it sets out some limited authorities for other agencies to exercise directly, not under DAS authority. So, for example, the Commissioner of Transportation in the Oregon Department of Transportation has authority for construction contracting. That's subject to 279, but that's not subject to DAS authority. On the other hand, part of what DOT buys, ODOT buys, is under DAS authority. Their services and supplies, not construction-related, would come under DAS authority. So in that case, DAS either sets the contract up or buys for them. So there's a list of the, on the left-hand side of this page, of the limited authorities that go to various agencies that are subject to 279. On the right-hand side, it lists the entities and gives some examples of the types of procurements that are not subject to 279. So, for example, the state lottery, the Oregon University System, SAFE, the legislative department, the judicial department, are not covered under ORS 279. They establish their own rules, but they're not subject to this particular provision of statute. And then also found in 279A025 is a listing of the kinds of procurements that aren't covered, or the kinds of expenditures that aren't covered under 279. We spent time this morning talking about debt service and debt instruments. None of those are covered under ORS 279, and those are specifically spelled out in statute. In the rewrite in the last session, a lot of time and effort was put towards going and looking through all of statute, pulling all of these exceptions into one place, and now they're largely found in ORS 279A025. Before, they were scattered throughout statute. It was really hard to understand what was covered and what wasn't covered. So I think this is a handy guide, and you might find it useful that section of statute in the future.
Chairman, I would say that that happened because under the leadership of both legislators Walt and Watt, we worked very, very hard on this because it was costing government too much money to have these things in all these different kinds of places. So I'm so glad to hear that at least there is some means of DAS having some control on how we, you know, we operate, because procurement is a big area and everybody going out doing their own thing was costing the state money.
Good point. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, on page 5, if you turn to page 5, this talks a little bit about the procurement and contracting rules. ORS 279 requires the Department of Justice to establish model procurement rules for all public agencies. So school districts, state agencies, counties, and cities, all covered under 279, have these model rules that they can follow if they choose to. It's a big job. And because it covers such a broad group, it's fairly high level and sometimes not as specific as individual agencies might need to guide their operations. So for that reason, the Department of Administrative Services has developed their own rules. Over the last 18 months, we've involved since the passage of the new procurement law in a major rewrite of our rules. I think we've got a well-written set of rules. We worked with the stakeholder group that involves suppliers and public agencies to develop a rule set to implement the new statute. And many of the rules we had been developed over time, and they didn't necessarily fit together. These have an eye towards reading clearly and fitting together and providing better control and guidance in some areas that we simply didn't have anything before. The one set of rules that we did not revise in this were the set of rules that involved the qualified rehabilitation facilities or persons with disabilities. That is under DAS authority. We have revised those rules about 12 months before we did this rule rewrite here. So this outlines the rules that will become operational on March 1st and the AG rules as well as the DAS rules. If you turn to page 6, it gives an overview of really the 5 basic types of contracts that we have. There are a lot of variants on these contracts, but generally there's a contract for supplies, which is anything from office supplies to dump trucks. We have trade service agreements. These are contracts for trade services, usually always on an hourly rate, and for things like carpenters, plumbers, groundkeepers, and so forth. Price agreements under the new law is considered a contract, but these are what we put into place. We think are very effective. We bid them, we award them, and they're agreement between a supplier and the state to furnish supplies to state agencies for specific prices over some period of time. DOJ doesn't define them specifically as contracts. It hadn't in the past. We've now defined them as a contract under the current law. Of course, we have public improvement contracts and then personal services contracts. One of the fundamental differences between public agencies and state agencies is in personal services contracts. We have very prescriptive rules around how personal services contracts are procured, and under the new rewrite, we treat them as under the same methods of source selection as we do for any other items. That leads us to page 7, methods of source selection. I've outlined at a high level the different kinds of methods of source selection. Generally, small procurements are under 5,000. Law does not require us to get quotes. By rule, we ask for quotes if they're practical. Over 5,000 to currently 75,000, we require 3 quotes. If it's a personal services, we require an informal proposal. The statute change that goes into effect in March 1st takes that threshold from $75,000 up to $150,000. So that's a change. And that $150,000 sets the floor for which a competitive bid would be issued or a full competitive seal proposal or a request for proposal, which has to be noticed and has to be awarded based on the criteria set out in the request for proposal. Moving to page 8, I've outlined really the alternative methods of source selection. The emergencies, which an agency must have a finding to enter into, and they must document the basis of source selection of the contractor, and the exemption request. Under current law, we have an exemption to statute that has to have either documentation and determination by either the director of DAS, or in the case of personal services, the state's chief procurement officer, and then by public agencies, by the local contract review board. That finding and that determination says that an alternative procurement method may be used when that method will not adversely impact competition, won't create bias, and will save the contracting agency money. The new law changed that to not make it cover the whole range of the statute, but to bring it to cover the methods of source selection and allows for a special procurement to be used when the other methods of source selection don't work and basically the same finding is made. It's been broadened for savings to be more than just to the contracting agency. It can be to the general public as well.
Okay, Mr. Hartwig, we gave you your 10 minutes, and now I know we got some questions lining up here. So,
thank you.
Senator Winters, and then Representative Smith, and then Senator Carter after that, and Senator Morrissey.
You mentioned that you have, you know, your rules and standards, and my question is, one, are they consistent? And I'm particularly talking about your bidder conference. And whether when you do your bidder conferences, whether it's done in person, whether it's done on phone, and whether it's done in such a manner that you don't end up later with having conflicts of someone not receiving the same and exact information.
Through the chair, Senator Winters, the rules around bidders conferences are primarily if they're mandatory, they have to. The people have to attend. If they're not mandatory, they don't have to attend. We must describe whether they're mandatory or not, and we have had a practice of allowing for bidders' conferences for people to participate over the telephone rather than bringing them here.
What are the determining factors that determine whether or not it becomes mandatory or not mandatory?
Through the chair, Senator Winters, it's really a judgment call on the part of the procurement officer that's handling that about whether or not that we need people to be there for that or not. So it's a judgment call.
So we really don't have hard and fast standards that deal with this. And you know where I'm going because of an issue that came up with respect to Smart Buy, and there's been some considerable discussions whether or not, you know, procedure and standards were used and whether or not, you know, so if it's kind of loosey-goosey, you know, do we need to have some kind of process that says, in this instance, if you're talking millions of dollars, which in the case we were, these are the protocols that we follow. If we're not, then you don't have to follow those protocols. Are you looking at that particularly?
Through the chair, Senator Winters, we will be looking at that. Thank you.
All right. We have Representative Smith, and then members, if you can just hold until after Senator Morissette's question, then we'll have one final comment from Representative Morgan about a member from the House who will be departing within the hour. So, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Doyle. Did I understand that you said under the personal services contract that you accept impersonal proposals? Or did I mishear that?
Through the chair, Representative Smith, I hope you misheard that, but I may have misspoke. Under current rules, we call informal request for proposals to be a requirement where we would require three proposals when it's a personal services contract and it is under $75,000. If the estimated value of the contract would exceed $75,000 for personal services under the current rule regime, then it would go to a formal competitive seal proposal or formal RFP. So it would be posted, it would be published and posted for some period of time, and any number of people who respond to that would submit. With the informal RFP, it's a requirement that we send the request for proposal to a minimum of three offerors. And then they would submit with some shorter time. But it's informal rather than personal.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for you to ask your question. Senator Carter.
Thank you. I'd like to make a statement, then you can return to. We had, we put the numbers for small procurements down to $75,000 for a reason. And that reason was because we were not having fairness when it comes to women and minorities in business. And so I regret the move at this particular time. But I would like to be assured, I'd like this committee to be assured, that there will be fairness
in the system to our small and businesses, and especially those businesses of women and minorities, because it was totally, totally unfair system. So we could do exactly what we did. 5,000 was a very small number. And it did keep you guys doing a lot of work just before your time when I said you guys. But it was because it was so unfair. So I, Mr. Chairman, I'd like for some time in the future for him to come back and let us know how the system is working, and if indeed, or either we could call the women and minority department in to program to come in and give us an overview of how that is working, because we know that a lot of women small businesses in the state hire other people than big companies, or other people will not hire. So I hope that you're watching that in, it's in tandem with the same question that, same concern that Senator Winters is having.
Good comment, Senator. And I think just given the way we've shortened the presentation anyway, there might be an opportunity that we can bring this back and cover that issue in a little bit more depth.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to do that. I would like to reply just briefly. Senator Carter, we are concerned about that as well. And at the end of this presentation, there's a couple of slides on the Oregon Procurement Information Network. Our plan is, and what we're working on, we don't have this yet, but we expect to have it, let's say, within the year, if not sooner, is that this new limit of $150,000, we will notice that over the Oregon Procurement Information Network, and we are working on making changes to that system so that OMWSB certified firms will get, regardless of the agency might have to only ask for three quotes, so they can ask for three quotes, but every registered certified OMWSB firm for that commodity or category will have a notice if they're on the system. So we think that we can make it better.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Morissette.
Yes, thank you. This is kind of a hypothetical, but it's an important question. Under emergency procurement, would the governor or the agency, DAS, have the authority to negotiate or purchase pharmaceuticals at the same price that the corrections department purchases them? If the intent was to create a lower cost for a designated group of uninsured people, for instance, purchasing from corrections is already purchased.
Through the chair, Senator Morissette, that's a complicated question. I think the short answer is, if I understand the contract that Corrections has for drugs and pharmaceuticals, I believe they're accessing that through the Western States Contracting Alliance, or the Minnesota Multi-State Drug and Pharmaceutical Contract. There's a provision in there that is only for public agency use and can't be resold to the general public. Otherwise, I had been told that then that begins to run afoul of antitrust provisions because there is a special distinction that allows political subdivisions and public organizations to do cooperative purchasing for themselves if it's not resold to a broader group. That's not a very good answer. I'd be happy to talk to you later about it, but it's a complex issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any closing comments?
There are slides about the Oregon Smart Buy project. I would urge you to take a look at that. We think that's a very successful project. We are working with agencies to drive savings. Right now, we found hard dollar impacts to be just over $9.1 million. We've analyzed expenditure at a high level. We brought it down to $300 million and did detailed review of the expenditures and the contracts. We benchmarked those contracts, and we went out and either advertised and resolicited. We've managed demand through either essential products lists or through standard configurations on PCs, and that has resulted in reduced expenditures against these contracts. These are significant savings. It's not been easy, as a number of you have alluded to, but the bottom line is these are improving the contracting outcomes for the benefit of the public and driving substantial savings.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. And as the members know, we are about to, at least on the House side, say farewell to one of our representatives and welcome them on the Senate, or her on the Senate side. But my hope is at least we're going to see the Senate President use the same wisdom that our House Speaker had in appointing her to the Ways and Means. So it may just be a shift in seat assignments from today to tomorrow. But I thought Representative Morgan might have a few comments about our Ways and Means member.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is an interesting occasion because it's the last possibility or opportunity that any of us are going to have to address Representative Johnson. From a little bit of time now forward, we're going to be calling you Senator Johnson, and I'm sure my colleagues on this side of the building will join me in congratulating you very warmly and recognizing a great match of task and talent here, and wish you all the best on the other side of the building. And also just to remind you of a very little known rule in full Ways and Means, that the newest members bring donuts for the first
I think I can try to rise to that obligation.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Westland.
As much as I look forward to those donuts, I sincerely have a great deal of desire in the donuts. I'm not so sure about the supposed new member of the Senate side, and let's not be presumptive. I mean, the Senate still has to speak on this, and as a matter of fact, the reason I've been absent so much of this committee is I've been working on a little constitutional issue that has surprisingly arisen, and I think I've got it handled, but you never guarantee anything in politics.
No.
But if the donuts are a sure deal, I mean, maybe I...
That's not, we might have to work out. Representative, have you resigned from the House yet?
I have, in fact. I am an an unemployed person, as I say.
Okay.
I think our Senate colleagues have an opportunity here.
I've just laid down my negotiating hand. I'm at their mercy now. The fridge behind me is a smoking ruin.
Senator Westland made sure that we have donuts. She just pledged.
I'm on those donuts.
Representative, any comment?
No, other than I have spoken with President Courtney, and I'm delighted that he has extended me the opportunity to continue to serve on Ways and Means. I am privileged to serve with you all, and I so appreciate the courtesies that have been extended to me on the House side. I'm looking forward to doing the same work on the Senate side, and enthusiastic about the session we have ahead under your Senator Schrader's leadership. Thank you.
All right. We are adjourned.